and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. No one ever said it would be easy to end the Ukraine conflict, particularly since the Ukrainians and the Europeans are determined to continue the war. With so much resistance in the West, it is overlooked that Russia still has the option of winning on the battlefield. Crosstalking difficult negotiations, I'm joined by my guest, Marco Gasic, in London. He's an international affairs commentator. In Hanover, we have Ike Hammer. He is an economist and political commentator. And here in Moscow, we cross to Johnny Miller. He is a journalist for Press TV. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Marco first in London. You know, obviously, over the last 2 weeks, watching these different peace plans coming from Trump, and then the Europeans have an option, then they drop theirs, and then they want to whittle away at Trump's, and then Marco Rubio jumps in here. Steve Witkoff, as we speak, are in Moscow right now, and they're all talking about these negotiations. But Marco, these are negotiations in the West. This has nothing to do with Russia at this point here. And I think that is overlooked way too often, because as I said in my introduction, if it's not a good deal, this conflict will continue. And that's not realized very much in the West. Go ahead.
There's certainly a lot of negotiation going on, and none of it with Russia at the moment, or none of it visibly with Russia at the moment. The effort to build a European and a US consensus seems to be a difficult one. Whether this is actually the reality, we don't know, because there are elements within, obviously, very significant elements in the US military, industrial, financial and political structure that want the war to continue just as much as the Europeans appear to do. The Europeans may well be playing their game. They're allowing Trump to distance himself from the war and accentuate the business element of US-Russia interaction while keeping the war going and pressure on Russia. So these are, it may be a partly a charade for the cameras, but for the Europeans it's deadly serious, because they want to make sure that their political survival, that is their the European leaders' political survival, is guaranteed by the way the peace is made to appear, if peace has to appear. But at the moment, peace doesn't seem to suit their purpose or those who support them.
It's very interesting. Let me go to Ike in Hanover. Marco said something that is absolutely germane to what's going on here. The Europeans are more worried about their fate than the fate of Ukraine itself. That is the state of play right now. Ike, go ahead in Hanover.
Well, you have to consider that the Europeans have totally different ideas in the backhand, too. They want to form this European superstates, and therefore they really need war, because they have to get rid of these limitations from the contracts they wrote, like one, like that every country can stop very significant things. They need to get rid of these stoppings from Hungary, from Poland, from Czechoslovakia, and so on. The European bureaucracy wants just to rule. This is the one thing. The second thing is they need euro bonds, because they are basically bankrupt.
Yep.
They handed out money they don't have. They went already in the debts, and now they try to heal this somehow, and they really dearly want a war that they can say, oh, this is an emergency situation, you know, just the emergency, just once, you know, just once, and the hell breaks loose. That's the second thing. And the third thing is that NATO is on the brink. They are already called brain dead by, I think it was Macron,
yep.
and I think Donald Trump had similar visions on this too. And there are hundreds of thousands of bureaucrats who want to stay paid. And if the war is over, people will ask, well, hang on, 5% of GDP for these bureaucrats, what for? I mean, if they just lose, if they have not the military capacity to do anything, if they are just ending in corruption and so on and so on. And the fourth thing, of course, is it already got rumors that there are billions of dollars, billions, not millions, billions of dollars washed through this Ukraine war into hands somewhere and nobody exactly knows where. And of course, investigations have to be started. And when the war is over, you have the time and the possibility to start these investigations. And I can well imagine that some high officials in the West are very scared, especially in Europe, are scared of these investigations and don't want to anything to come up. So they are super interested in war. Unfortunately, on the back of all these millions of Ukrainian people, of Russian people, and this is the big disgrace in this game.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Particularly, it was a conflict that could have been easily avoided. You know, Johnny, we had in the last news cycle, the NATO's top military officer, he floated the idea of a preemptive attack on Russia. This is NATO, a preemptive attack on Russia, and they would define it as being defensive. I guess we've reached the Orwellian moment here in this conflict. They're going to start preemptively attack Russia and say, but we're only doing it in self-defense. This is where we are. Meanwhile, there's supposed to be negotiations going on. Johnny.
Well, I agree with your other guests. And what's worrying, it does look like Zelensky's time is going to be up soon. He's hanging by a thread. But the fear is, then who is his replacement going to be? Well, the British, it looks like, would very much like Zeluzhny. And Zeluzhny, the former general, now ambassador in the UK, has just written a piece, I think, in the British press with his path to victory. It's amazing that the Ukrainians and the British have finally figured out a path to victory in Ukraine. It would have helped if they did that 3 years ago. But Zeluzhny's ideas are extreme. He even floats the idea of Ukraine being given nuclear weapons. If that was to happen, we'd be closer to the end of the world at any time in our history. So that's the danger here. I mean, we could do many shows criticizing Trump and Trump policy around the world. But I have to say, I have a lot of respect for Trump in regards to his policies on Ukraine. I do believe that he wants peace. I do believe he's tried. He faced an assassination attempt, which may well have been linked to Ukraine. And he's fighting huge forces in the United States and huge forces, most of Europe, trying to stop it.
Yeah, Johnny, just to stay with you, I mean, I can be sympathetic to your argument there, but one thing that I have a problem with is Marco Rubio. I mean, this is a person that is has a long history of being a war hawk, a neocon, and why is he fiddling with the Witkoff plan when apparently Trump blessed it? See, that's why I started the program. Let me go to Marco here. This debating within the West isn't getting us anywhere because it's just looking for roadblocks and obstacles.
Well, this is the element where I feel that they might be playing good cop, bad cop, Americans and the Europeans. Essentially, the Americans produce a nice, friendly-looking peace plan or draft form, which seems to have all the things that Russia would actually want among the things it doesn't want, but certainly lots of constructive elements to it, from demilitarization of Donbass to nuclear treaty restarting and so on and so forth. And then it goes off to the Europeans, who then put their puny little paws onto the no signature and start raising issues. And then poor old Rubio and poor old America, which has got no power at all over the big beastly European leaders like Starmer and Macron, is forced to kind of reevaluate the whole thing. And we're back to a kind of square one, while in the meantime, flushing out Russia's views in public on things like using its own money for rebuilding Ukraine, its own frozen funds. So there seems to be an element of a deliberate play acting in this entire scenario. And as I say, that may reflect the existence of other interests in the US, and I'm sure it does,
but Marco,
beyond Trump's.
But
and those
Marco,
other interests are neocon interests, military industrial complex interests, defense industry interests, and corruption interests, indeed, on the whole totality of what we're discussing. So it isn't easy to see where this is heading when you've got all those jockeying interests wanting the war to continue.
Yeah, but let's go to Hanover. But meanwhile, while all these dinners and cocktail parties and negotiations are going on, the conflict continues in Ukraine. And the Russians have made it very clear, if you don't give us a good deal, don't present a good deal, then we're just going to keep on going. I guess maybe the Europeans are pleased with that, and possibly given Marco's arguments, maybe the Americans are happy with it. So this is all theater. We're just observing theater. Go ahead, Aika.
Well, I'm not sure whether this is all theater, but I could imagine that the US government is not really in charge of everything. You shouldn't have to forget that there is a so-called deep state, and it is trying to sabotage the Trump administration wherever they can. They have already postponed to introduce more than 100 key figures in the government. They cannot be put into place because the socialists or Democrats, how they are called there, are postponing the election or the nomination of these people. And I could well imagine that there are parts of the Foreign Secret Service who just went out of control. And unfortunately, this part has an own budget, maybe even more than $1 trillion annually. And these people might be in the position of thinking, okay, we can just hide for 4 years, and then we are rid of this new president. And Rubio is put with information, fake information, from here and there, so that he is trying to do the right thing, but on a very problematic database. And if we just consider that the former chief of the DIA, General Flynn, just said we have to get rid of some parts of this foreign secret service, then there must be a much deeper problem than we all in the in front of the cameras know, or behind the screens know. So I think this is more the problem. They are in good faith because they cannot afford these wars anymore. America cannot afford it anymore, so they have to stop it. But I think there are, even in the administration, in the US administration, there are still parts who try to keep this war alive at any means, and who are big partners of the British and the European, their partners, to save their democracy.
Well, it's not our democracy. I think I want to talk about saving face, because I think that's an important element here. But gentlemen, I'm going to interrupt myself. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on difficult negotiations. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelle. To remind you, we're discussing difficult negotiations. Okay, let's go to Johnny here in Moscow. In this program and all of the programs on this topic over the last 3 years, almost 4 years, we've talked about the costs, the real costs, the costs in lives, the damage to economies, trade, globalization, integration. I've approached this 1,001 different ways, okay? But there's one thing that's really hard to explain is the war fervor in Europe and the irrationality that we have coming out of European capitals and political parties. And I think you can distill it down to, we just can't let the Russians win, which is kind of an infantile approach, because it should be about security for all, ending the violence, ending the conflict, and creating a security architecture in which everybody can live in the same neighborhood. But it's more of a psychological barrier for mostly Europeans, not so much with this administration in the United States, but they have their eyes on places like Venezuela right now. But it's more of a psychological mindset that you just can't negotiate with. You can't talk to these people.
Well, they fooled themselves with their own propaganda. When the conflict started, of course, Russia Today was banned. That would have been a good opportunity for people to see the other side. A lot of work that I've done over the last 3 years, and something that's very, very important to me, is how Britain and Europe have shut down opposition to the war. You have British academics who spoke out at the beginning of the conflict. They were threatened with the loss of their jobs. There was a well-known German political analyst. She's now being in court for plagiarism, I believe, because she stood up against NATO's actions in Ukraine. I myself am under political asylum in Russia because I fear arrest. If I go back to the UK, the famous Scottish politician George Galloway has just gone into exile. Yep. Because he was detained by British police when he came back from Moscow. So there's been a massive concerted effort to shut down opposition voices within Europe. If you're a journalist, if you're an academic, if you're politicians, you'll be smeared, your career will be ruined. And that's one of the main reasons they've been able to do it. Where are the Russia experts? I think you've got two excellent Russia experts on your show today, but most of them have been shut down. And so you have British intelligence French-German intelligence, you completely miscalculated from the very beginning what would happen in this conflict. I think most people on the show today knew what would happen in this conflict to the last Ukrainian, that the Russian economy would not collapse, that ultimately Russia would prevail, and that the British and German and European economies would be damaged. Many of us said it, but those who said it loudly were shut down. And that's what's happened. They believed their own propaganda, and their intelligence on this war has been a tragic failure.
Yeah, Marco, as part of my job, unfortunately, I have to look at the British media. The British media is just, it's psychopathic. I mean, there's always been a very strong strand of Russophobia in British political culture, but this has gone beyond it. I mean, the Starmer and his party are very, very unpopular, and so is the opposition. They're unpopular as well here. And he's still talking about sending money to Ukraine, involving the UK in a possible military adventure after a ceasefire, which the Russians will never agree to here. I mean, it's almost a form of political suicide all across the continent, because they can't allow the perception of Russia prevailing. I mean, they're willing to sacrifice a lot for this.
They are, what they're not willing to sacrifice is their projection of power and their self-image. I mean, British Russophobia dates from about the end of the Napoleonic Wars. It's been there for about 200 years and rising. And it's from a time when Britain was an actual valid competitor to Russia, Imperial Russia at the time, in colonial land grabs and so on and so forth. Britain viewed itself as a world player. Britain is now going through the semblance of pretending to be a world player, and that does involve talking loudly and carrying promising to carry a big stick, but the actual reality is anything but. But this is about projecting also the image of power for the political leaders who are pulling Britain into this direction. And they've created a kind of orthodoxy here where you have to just basically say the anti-Russian thing before you say anything else. You start off with that. That's the start point there. In Parliament, in the Lords, there's probably about two or three people who are able or willing to say anything that might suggest another view actually exists. So, it is very concerning. I mean, what they want now, of course, is to twist or get the Russians to accept the element in the peace deal where they can project further power right into Ukraine, into Kiev, into Odessa, as Macron said, with their so-called reinsurance forces, because that would present the Europeans, including the UK, as being real major players. And of course, that would be a great basis which to say to the already impoverished public, well, look, we're there in a crucial strategic place. We need to increase the armaments of Ukraine. We need more money to do so, more pounds in the weapons pocket. So you have to do your national duty. It's important for all of us that we carry on financing the defense industrial complex. So really, it's all about projecting the image of power now, because the real power has gone and left them a long time ago.
Yeah, I agree with Marco here, but one would have the impression that the UK and the EU are at war with Russia, but they're not, okay? I mean, the war footing and the Eastern Front and flanks and all, that's all the language of war, in which there is no state of war going on. And furthermore, Aika, you know, talking about these negotiations, let's recall, we had a process in Minsk. It was called the Minsk process. Then a few weeks after, or almost immediately after the start of the special military operation, there were talks in Istanbul. An agreement was initialed. It was almost a done deal. The British crashed that, with American backing. And now we have Anchorage, and then we have Rubio, and Witkoff, and Jared Kushner, and all. The gang is back, okay? Well, why would the Russians believe any of this? We've been to this rodeo a few times already. Because I have to express to all of you, there's a lot of skepticism here. We've seen this before. Aika.
Well, you're absolutely right with the skepticism, because it is very confusing. The German population is very, very friendly with the Russians. We have many friendships left from the former GDR times in East Germany. We have a very important minority of Russians living in Germany. And I can just say the ordinary person on the street, who is not just a propaganda victim, is likes the Russians and has no interest in war at all. It is a tiny minority which is in power. They don't even got 20% of the promotion of the people. I mean, you have to understand that in Germany, you can be in power without the majority of the people in favor of you. This is a really tiny wee little thing, and they are so woven into these international, especially these American and British networks, that they are not acting, and we see it in many, many other topics, domestic topics too. They are not acting in behalf of the German or the European people. They are acting in behalf of their networks. And this is so confusing because they are warmongers like hell. They are personally possible at war with Russia, but they are also at war with Donald Trump and his government. And this is going more and more obvious. So, but the German people, and I guess most of the European people are not at all hostile against Russians, and they want nothing more but friendship. We had always the best times, economic best times, cultural best times, when Germany and Russia were friendly with each other, had trade and did business with each other. And this is where we want to get there. Of course, the British always, for 300 years, the British tried everything to split the Germans from the Russians, because they want to have control from the outside. They want to mess up the continental Europe to be able to rule outside, from the outside and outside. And the French are in the backyard now too, because they see when the Germans and the Russians work together, they are just visitors on the side stone. That's why they are against this too. And the Polish always were against this, because they are they are in between these powers, and they have to they never liked a friendship between Germany and Russia. So these are these old interests who are still in the powers that be, who are there, but the people are really trying to have friendship. And honestly, I think we are on the brink that we get this friendship. I think the times of the European superstate are over. We are turning to the de Gaulle model, which says national states, sovereign national states working together peacefully. And I think this will be the model for the anti-Eurasian continent. And I think it's already that the Trump administration is agreeing with this. That's why they are already talking about multipolar things that they're already talking about.
I don't know about that. I mean, they seem to want to lock up the hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, for themselves. We'll see how that plays out. Johnny, as we rapidly run out of time here, you know, experiencing all of this, Russia isn't alone. It's not isolated. It's very much part of the world right now. And Russians can live. Russians like Europe, like Europeans. Their attitudes towards Germans are beginning to change, obviously for historical reasons. But you know, Russia doesn't really need Europe. And as long as the further this goes on, the less they actually care. Go ahead, Johnny.
No, absolutely. I mean, and I've been in Moscow for some time now, and increasingly people who know Moscow and Western Europe are increasingly saying that Moscow is a more comfortable place to live. I mean that by the standard of living, the clean streets, etc. The Russian economy is stable. And you're right in saying that Russian people don't have that hatred. When they find out I'm Scottish, sometimes you have these old babushkas who launch into Robert Burns poem, My Heart is in the Highlands, because it was taught in Soviet schools. And that's the crucial thing. I mean, I've been fighting for 3 years, on the front line of Donbass and here in Moscow, for there to be peace and good relations between Russia and Europe. Because from the Russian people, it's certainly possible, but the European governments need to recognize that they've made serious mistakes and that the future of Europe and the European economy relies on good relations with Russia. That's clear for all to see.
Yeah, and what we've all learned, this whole, I call it the Ukraine project. It's not organic. It is elite-driven. And when you go down to general populations, people say, this is not my, I didn't vote for this, the common saying is now. All right, gentlemen, fascinating discussion. We've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in London, Hanover, and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.